are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 12th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from the Nation magazine, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, Ari Berman. On the voting suppression we are seeing already in primaries and the implications of that Evanwell decision last week. Meanwhile, equal pay day, ladies and gentlemen. The pay gap. Both about discrimination and choices. Goldman Sachs to pay $5 billion in fines, except for not really that much. No. They're going to get bonus credit for all sorts of things. Sanders pushes a national fracking ban. Social Security weaponized by Democrats against other Democrats. I'm in heaven. We're 1 week from the New York primary. We'll check in on that. North Carolina residents keep losing because of their hate legislation. Tennessee up next for more hate. Right to work for less struck down in Wisconsin on terms that are actually going to be really interesting to talk about. I don't know that it's going to be maintained. Rick Scott, Governor A-hole, and a Democracy Spring protest gets a couple of folks that you know arrested in Washington, D.C. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz's campaign, feeling the heat. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Programming note, I've been doing a lot of pre-tapes, and because I'm going to be traveling next week to Vegas, we're going to have a show live from Vegas for a couple of those days, but I'm going to be at least one or two travel days, and then the following week, ostensibly going to be on vacation. It's going to be all new shows for you, and I should also tell you that I have some inner ear problem. So as I'm talking, I'm actually hearing like some type of weird feedback in my ear. Really disconcerting. But what are you going to do?
How's your knee doing?
My knee is also a problem. It's all falling apart, folks. Soon I'll just be a voice. In a disembodied, they'll just keep me in some type of like beaker.
Wait, Social Security still solvent?
Right. Oh, I mean, I'll be just some floating goo in a beaker, and I'll be able to hopefully continue to talk. I wanted just to briefly mention this right to work was struck down in Wisconsin by a state court. It's going to end up going to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and my guess is it's going to be reversed. But it is relevant. I think I mentioned last week that one of the pre-tapes we did turned out to be a professor I had at BU, property rights professor. And I don't know if we spoke about this specific dynamic, but the interesting thing in this ruling is that the court ruled. Now, the court ruled that right-to-work legislation, and this is sort of the conservative libertarian argument as to why right-to-work legislation is wrong, because it actually does two things. One, it imposes itself in a contract between unions and employers, where the contract where the employer engages in the contract with the union, saying you are going to be the exclusive representative of people in this shop. And this right to work legislation basically says that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case, that unions don't necessarily have to get paid for their representation of all the workers. And in that case, it's actually like a property rights taking. That but for the intervention of the state, based upon the agreement between them and their employer, this is a taking. And it'll be more clear, I think, when we have this conversation, when you hear this conversation that I did with this Joseph Singer. But the idea is that, you know, one person's property right is in some way taking away another person's property right. And the implications of that are that there is no natural state that we love to, that libertarians love to talk about. There is no natural state. Once the state gets involved in even establishing a property right, you may have a right to property, but so doesn't the other person. And so we can write in, you know, in a founding document that we have an inalienable right to property, or you can perceive one. But rights end at the other person's nose. And the fact is, once you take some property, some instances you're actually taking a swipe at somebody else's nose. This becomes more clear when I talk to this professor back in the time where I didn't get my sort of like a rambling noise in my ear every time I spoke.
Your nose can speak to my nose at my court after I see you in your court.
We should have Walter Block
I know,
back on.
It's sort
talk
of
about
like
his
not getting
Trump.
A call from the whack pack for a while.
I know. It feels a little weird, but I want to remind you, if you are a libertarian, you want to call in at the end of the program, please do so. Also, another reminder. I looked at Midroll. I think we're going to have some libertarian ads soon. I'm not kidding, and I'm going to do them. I'm going to read them because we've charged them an exorbitant CPM.
Market but, rate.
Right. Oh, yeah, beyond
market.
Supermarket.
Supermarket.
Supermarket
rate. What could
rate.
Be better than a supermarket?
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. This, if you have heard me say Just Coffee on this program, which means if you've ever heard this program before, this is your opportunity to buy it. And try it out. 30% off this month only. You only have half the month left. 30% off. Because you're going to want to place an order today so that you can get more in April at a 30% discount if you use the coupon code MRSPRING16. MRSPRING16. Free shipping, 30% off. Just coffee. Great coffee. Fair trade. Organic if you want it, 30% off. Give me a break. And just a reminder, this show relies on your membership. If you have the means to become a member, please do so today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We can't do it without you. And by you, I'm not even talking about, we wouldn't even be talking right now, or we would be, but you wouldn't be hearing us, were it not for the existing members. But, you know, people... people run into financial troubles. They have to suspend their memberships. I have no problem with that, and you know, or suspend their payments. And you know, as always, we help folks out. if they need help with and want access to the fun half of the show. But it is the continuous sort of filling that gap with new members, which is what keeps the show chugging along. So if you have yet to support the show, it's just literally nickels a week. Pennies. It's pennies. But who has that many pennies these days? 30 cents. You have 30 pennies a day? No. But you got six nickels. I know you do. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ari Berman. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone, it's always a pleasure to welcome this young man to the program. He is from The Nation magazine. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He is so knowledgeable. I was just saying this this morning, Ari. First off, welcome to the program.
Good to talk to you, Sam. Young at heart, maybe.
Well, your book has won amazing accolades. I know you're still on tour with it. And I have to say that I realized this today or yesterday, and I was saying this morning in the office, that when I book you on the program, I feel guilty because you know so much about this stuff. I don't have to do anything. I just sit back and it's like I feel like guilty. Because there is no greater expert, I think, in the country, I mean, who, and maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong, but maybe there's some lawyer somewhere in the Department of Justice, but who understands voting rights and the attempts to suppress it that are going on across the country more than you do. And maybe you shouldn't even tell me, because maybe I'll start booking them. But
I think that basically you shouldn't even be doing this interview. I should just be interviewing myself based on that introduction.
I mean, I think at some level, maybe we could work something like
that.
Why
are you still talking, Sam? No.
It's not the first time I've been asked.
You are the great. You are the great facilitator.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But and the irony, of course, is we're talking about the great disfacilitators, or whatever. What is that word? I don't know. But it's Ari Berman. Someone just told me I didn't say your whole name. But really, it's more important that people pick.
Wait,
up.
I'm trying to tweet this now that I'm on. Hold on. Has this been made public yet? This appearance? Hold on.
Yeah, no, the tweet. Yes, of course, your appearance is made public, and then you know people
on at Majority FM.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's how he rolls. All right, look, let's stop your tweeting. Let's get down to brass tacks. I want to talk about Evanwell, this most recent voting decision in at the Supreme Court, and I want to talk to you about the death of Antonin Scalia because. We did not anticipate that. I mean, people knew that he was going to die eventually, but not at this juncture. But I want to go back to a couple of weeks ago. There were the first big major, I think, example of voting problems we saw in the context of the primary was in Arizona in late March. And there were extremely long lines. And this was a function of a decision to basically create long lines, it sounds like. Tell us what happened in Arizona.
So in Arizona, Maricopa County, the largest county in the state, decided to close 70% of their polling places, ostensibly to save money. They went from 200 polling places in 2012 to just 60 polling places in 2016, and actually it was even worse than that because there was 400 polling places in 2008. So they really went from 400 polling places in 2008, the last time there was two contested presidential primaries, to just 60 polling places in 2016, and there were extremely long lines in places like downtown Phoenix because of this. And what I pointed out in my article about it was that Arizona was one of those states with a long history of voting discrimination that previously had to approve its changes, its voting changes, with the federal government under a section of the Voting Rights Act that was invalidated by the Supreme Court. So had the Voting Rights Act been at full strength, Maricopa County, Arizona, would have had to approve this voting change with the federal government. I don't believe the federal government would have approved it because minority voters are 40% of Maricopa County, and there was clear evidence that this left minority voters worse off. Even if they had approved the change, people would have known for months that it was coming. They could have voted early or absentee, and either way, there would not have been five-hour lines at the polls.
And so, I mean, this is a prime example of, and just to refresh people's memories, the Supreme Court essentially left the preclearance provision in the Voting Rights Act. There were a dozen states or so, more counties across the country that needed preclearance because of their past history of discrimination. They left that provision in, but they invalidated the formula that existed and said to Congress, create a new formula. And of course, Congress said, we don't do anything. And so there's no formula there. So everybody who had to be pre-cleared prior to this time can just basically create. I mean, it's almost like these are, it's like the mad scientist. Like, we're just going to try this and see if this helps suppress votes, right? I mean, that's basically what we're in now.
Well, so what I've been saying for a long time is that this is the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, and this is the first presidential election since the Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act, and we're going to see problems somewhere, probably in multiple places, and sometimes you know where the problems are going to occur. Like in North Carolina, where there's lots of voting restrictions in effect, sometimes you don't know where they're going to occur. And the Maricopa County thing caught everyone off guard. I didn't know that they'd closed 70% of their polling places. I don't think anyone who didn't live there knew this. But when it happened, they quickly became a poster child for the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. I think everyone can instinctively understand the problem with five-hour lines. It doesn't take a whole lot of explanation. It affects hundreds of thousands of voters. It affects people of every single party, although it affects some more than others. And I think, like Florida in 2012, when people see these really long lines, it seems to resonate in a way that other voting problems do not. Mm. And so I think once Maricopa County happened, everyone realized, oh my God, there's a problem.
But there's no fix here, is there? I mean, is there a fix to Maricopa? Because it's the bottom line is if the governor says, we're not going to fix it, they're just not going to fix it.
Well, there's a fix in Maricopa because they've already said that they're going to have many more polling places because there was such an outcry. But the problem is in other places, the fix is much more difficult. In states like Texas, where they just keep refusing to get rid of their voter ID law, even though it gets struck down over and over in court. It just the litigation takes forever. You're relying on very conservative courts in these southern states to hear these cases. And it's difficult, absent a political solution, to make a whole lot of progress. That everything is now taking place in the courts. We don't know what will happen in the lower courts. The Supreme Court is deadlocked. We never know what's going to happen there. So there's a lot of uncertainty in a bunch of key states heading into the November election. And the fact that we're seeing problems in the primaries is very worrisome because we're going to see a lot more problems in the general.
I mean, how much do you want to bet? Because now longtime listeners of this program know that you and I have a long history of betting. You have an equally long, almost identically long history of losing bets to me. How much do you want to bet that in Maricopa County, they're going to have too few polling places in the general election? They're going to add some, and there's still going to be another problem. They're going to innovate their way into creating another problem.
Well, at the risk of losing to you again, I actually am fairly certain that Maricopa County may be the one place in America that won't have these problems because they got so much bad press that I think, if anything, they'll overcompensate. And I don't want to say they'll have too many polling places because I don't know if you can actually have too many polling places. But I think that they'll make adjustments. And so I think that is not a place that I am concerned about any longer, though you never know what will happen when the media fades. But I'm extremely concerned about all these places where there are new voting laws in effect, because Maricopa County was not one of these places that had, for example, a new voter ID law, or had cut back on early voting, or had cut back on same-day registration. Those are things that we're seeing in North Carolina and Wisconsin and in other states. And so those are the states that I'm most concerned about. Those also happen to be important swing states as well.
All right, let's talk about Wisconsin, because the pieces that you wrote about Wisconsin, I thought were great examples. In fact, on Twitter, people would, because I was on Hayes, and they played that clip of that Grothman, the mm-hmm. Wisconsin, I think he's a state senator, or maybe he's a congressman.
He's now a congressman.
Yeah, former state senator. And when he was in the state Senate, they passed the voter ID law, or photo ID. Mm-hmm. And this guy said, when asked by a reporter, why do you think the Republicans can win the presidency in Wisconsin this year? And he said, well, I think, they're going to have a very weak candidate, the Democrats, and photo ID should really help us out. And of course, the reporter followed up with, do you really think they're going to have a weak candidate? Like, as if like this guy didn't just say, here's the keys to the castle. And let's talk about this, because your pieces, and I want to get back to Grothman in a second, but your piece is outlined, and so someone tweeted at me, like, why should photo ID be a problem? Your piece outlined very specific cases, and there are tens of thousands of cases like this where people are basically priced out of, in some ways, getting an ID. Just walk us through how that happens.
So the problem in Wisconsin is that 300,000 registered voters, according to a federal court, don't have a government-issued photo ID. And to get this ID, basically, you have to go to the DMV and either get a driver's license or a state ID. To get these things, you need underlying documents, like, in many cases, a birth certificate. Well, if you don't have a birth certificate, for example, or you don't have easy access to it, this can start costing a lot of money and be a very difficult process. So I've been detailing stories of people who, for example, have had to pay hundreds of dollars to get their birth certificate, who haven't had a birth certificate, so have had to pay lots of money for alternative documents, who have had documents but their name has been misspelled, for example, or other tiny little things that wouldn't have mattered in the past, and now they're having to go to court to correct them. And so basically what's happening in Wisconsin is this is a new form of a poll tax, that people are either having to spend hundreds of dollars to get all of their documents in order, to get an ID that they've never needed to vote in the past, or they're just deciding they can't afford it, that they can't afford to lose their Social Security payments, or they can't afford to do all of these things in order to be able to vote, because they've never had any problem voting in the past. Many of these are elderly voters that have voted in every single election. There's one story I told, the lead plaintiff in the ACLU case challenging the voter ID law is an 89-year-old woman named Ruthel Frank. She's been voting since 1948. She's an elected member of her town council in Wisconsin, but nonetheless, she was told she needs a birth certificate to get a photo ID for voting. She's never had her birth certificate before. The name is misspelled, and she would have to pay $200 to change her birth certificate. And she's like, I'm 89 years old. I never needed a birth certificate before. Why would I pay hundreds of dollars now for a document that I never needed, especially when there's no evidence of fraud to necessitate it? So the key point, part of this Glenn Grothman quote was twofold. Number one, he was admitting that voter ID laws were going to give Republicans an advantage, which is something that other Republicans have admitted in the past. The second thing is he was saying that because he believed that there was all this fraud that was committed by Democrats in the past, which is also completely untrue, because Wisconsin didn't present a single case of voter impersonation when they were in court, which is, you think, the very time that you would present this evidence if you had it.
Well, that's the part. I mean, look, the first part you mentioned, like, oh, that's just me analyzing the implications of a law. We do that all the time. But the second part was really the part that really struck me. If he is making the argument that the election is going to change this time, he is, if not explicitly, certainly implicitly, but really explicitly saying the reason why Democrats won the presidency in Wisconsin in years past has because tens of maybe even hundreds of thousands of votes were fraudulent. I mean, this is...
Yeah, that's what he's saying.
That's
what he's saying. Because,
just
I mean,
shocking.
Democrats have won 7 straight presidential elections in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin Republicans are convinced that it's happening because too many college students and too many African Americans in Milwaukee are voting. I mean, it's very clear that these are the targets of these new laws. And basically, even though again and again and again, it's been shown that there is no voter impersonation, it is either an article of faith among Republicans that Democrats are committing voter fraud, or they're just using this as a very convenient excuse, and I believe it's the latter. Using it as a very convenient excuse to try to make it harder for their political opponents to vote in the first place.
So, okay. So if the ACLU prevails in Wisconsin on their challenge of the photo ID, if they prevail, does that, what happens to that case, A? B, if it ultimately is upheld that the photo ID is wrong, does a case like that become a factor in the opt-in? And just explain to people what I mean by that. In other words, can the DOJ opt them back in to pre-clearance? Oh, I'm not saying Wisconsin was there necessarily, but could they push Wisconsin into an opt-in situation?
I don't think so. I mean, the problem with the Wisconsin voter ID law is that the circuit court already upheld it, and a panel of Republican judges upheld this very swiftly in an extremely partisan decision that was like sort of breathtaking in just how partisan it was. There was a hearing on this law in 2014, and then it was upheld the same day, which just never, ever, ever happens. Usually these appeals courts take a while to rule on it, and the Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So for now, this is the end of it. The ACLU is in court trying to get Wisconsin to accept more IDs. They've already said they'll accept veterans' IDs, which is a step forward, though it was quite frankly absurd they didn't accept them in the first place. This is a difficult case. I mean, the lawyers are trying to get the full circuit court to hear this, but this is the problem with relying on the courts, is that sometimes you'll win and sometimes you'll lose, but it's going to take an extremely long time, it's going to cost a lot of money, and there's going to be a tremendous amount of uncertainty regardless of the final outcome. And this is what we're seeing not just in Wisconsin, but in North Carolina and Texas and Virginia and all these different states. And that's why the Voting Rights Act was important in the first place, because it blocked many of these laws from ever becoming law. So it blocked things before they even took effect in many states.
Yeah, but I mean, what's the solution if it's not the courts? I mean, you're not going to get, you can't go state by state and get new legislation. And we're certainly not going to get any federal legislation. I mean, it seems to me like it's both, well, I mean, I guess when the Democrats controlled both houses and had veto-proof majorities, their presumption was, well, it's not like the Supreme Court is going to find the Voting Rights Act to not be legitimate, right? I mean, that was so far-fetched, I guess, at that point. But
well, I mean, I think the point is there's short-term solutions and there's long-term solutions. In short-term, yeah, you try to go to court. In long-term, you try to get legislation, both in terms of the Voting Rights Act and in terms of other things, other protections, to try to prevent the situation from happening in the future. And then ultimately you have to elect people who have a different way of thinking. I mean, as long as the Republican Party believes in voter suppression, and as long as Republicans are in control of all these states, it's going to be very, very difficult to really fight these laws long term. Ultimately, you have to get different people in there that think differently, and that's going to be the quickest way to solve the problem. I think this is also ultimately going to be a political solution, not a legal solution.
But do you think Democrats are really keyed in on this issue? Because, you know, one would have thought that after 2000, we would have seen more to to create a federal standard and to create some federal guidelines. I mean, I want to get to Evanwell and the court in a moment, but give me your assessment of the Democrats' understanding of this issue at this point, if it's changed. And then I have a subsidiary question about motor voter, because I'm completely confused about that. But go ahead.
I think the Democrats have gotten better. I don't think that they're all good, and I don't think that they've all been as aggressive as they could be. I noticed when I first started covering this after the 2010 election that the Democratic Party basically wasn't doing anything, that they were so shell-shocked by their losses, they weren't challenging any of these new voting restrictions. Now they've gotten better. In many states, they don't have majorities to block things, but in states where they have large majorities, like California, for example, they've begun to be much more aggressive in trying to expand voting rights. So the party hasn't been great across the board. They've certainly become better. I think both of the leading Democratic candidates for president, Hillary and Bernie, have been good on voting rights. I'd like to hear both of them talk about it more. But nonetheless, they've both been good on the issue, particularly in contrast to the Republicans. I mean, I think basically the fact that the Republicans have gone so far to the right on this issue from just the very recent past has been the biggest story. And I don't think the story has been Democrats fail to fight for voting rights. I think it's been Republicans are just restricting voting rights everywhere, and you can't stop them in a lot of places.
Yeah, just to remind everybody, I mean, in 2007, the Voting Rights Act, was it 2007 or 2006?
2006.
It was almost unanimous, right? I mean, in the Senate. To reauthorize it, right? Was it maybe two votes?
It was 390-33 in the House and 98-0 in the Senate.
Okay. So, I mean, that's about as close to unanimous as you get, right? As opposed to, like, naming a post office after Ronald Reagan, I guess, would be the only other thing that would get you more Republican votes.
Those two Republicans that didn't show up for the vote would have made it there.
Right, exactly. They would have come in and voted four times. So, all right, so explain to me. Somebody asked me the other day about motor voter, and I was because in the context of an ID, you can now, if you get a driver's license, right, be automatically registered to vote. Is that a federal law? Is that, do I have that right?
No. So under the Motor Voter Act of 1993, you are required to be able to register at a federal agency, but they're not required to register you, if that makes sense. So if you sign up to get a driver's license, you're not automatically registered to vote unless you say you want to be registered. Now in Oregon and California, which are the first two states to do this, you are automatically registered, right, if you're a U.S. citizen, and then you can opt out. So it's basically an expansion of motor voter. Instead of a voter having to say, I want to register, you're automatically going to be registered, and then you can opt out at a later date.
And what do they do about citizenship relative to, I guess, a driver's license? I mean, I guess here's the rub, right, is that do you have to show proof of citizenship when you register in these instances?
No, I don't know how it works in Oregon. I know in California, if you're an undocumented immigrant or a naturalized immigrant and you're driving, you have a separate license. So in that case, you're not automatically going to be registered to vote because you'll have a completely separate process. There are built-in checks to make sure that non-citizens are not registering. To begin with, there's a very, very small number of non-citizens who are registered, period. And even if they're registered, there's no evidence that they actually ever vote. But I think there's checks and balances built into the system to make sure that non-citizens are not going to be registered.
You don't think undocumented immigrants are pouring over the border to sway our county elections or anything like that?
Well, that is certainly what the Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach and many other people, probably Trump, will start making that argument soon enough, especially if Ted Cruz steals any more delegates from him. But it doesn't make any logical sense. Why would someone who is presumably here to work decide to vote, risk a felony, and then be deported?
Ari, they come here just to sway our elections, and they go back because George Soros pays them to do it. That's their job, Ari. They get paid to come across the border and then go back after they vote. And you mentioned Kris Kobach. And apparently the Kansas Secretary of State put out Spanish language voter guides, which included two errors about registering to vote in the state. It gave the wrong date deadline and wrong sort of, I guess, reflection of what the rules were. But
I'm sure it was just a coincidence.
I'm sure that was just an honest mistake. Tell us about Evan Well. This it took me a while to understand this, the implications of this, of the ruling on the future of this argument. But this was brought by your favorite buddy. What's his name? Blum? Is that it? From the same people who brought us the Voting Rights Act, the Shelby County
Ed
challenge.
Ed Blum.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Ed Blum.
Tell us about Evan Well.
So Ed Blum and his group, the Project on Fair Representation, which have basically been started to challenge things like the Voting Rights Act with a tremendous amount of support from the largest funders in the conservative movement. After successfully challenging the Voting Rights Act, he then challenged the principle of one person, one vote. And essentially, the way districts have been drawn for over 50 years is they're based on total population. So everyone who lives in an area is counted, and that's how districts are then drawn in terms of total population. What Blum wanted to do was for districts to be drawn based on eligible or registered voters. So you had to be a voter or a would-be voter to be counted. And that meant that a lot of people would not be counted, including children, for example, who are not 18 and thus not eligible or registered voters.
But why would, Ari,
go ahead,
hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of children who presumably would go to a school, like a public school, or need like services like maybe doctors or healthcare, or why would that be relevant? I mean, why?
Well, basically the idea that he was arguing was that for it to be fair to all voters, only voters should be able to count. So if for some reason one community had a lot more children than another community, they would get more representation than the next place. That was the argument that Blum was making. The problem is, as you mentioned, that everyone is in some way entitled to representation. Everyone is in some way represented, whether you're a child or you're a non-citizen or you're in prison. I mean, everyone in some way or another is represented by their elected officials. And not only that, but total population was the easiest way to do this because the census didn't just measure, for example, registered or eligible voters. So there was both a logical reason to count everybody, but it was also just the easiest way to do things as well. And so that was always the standard, and they wanted to change the standard based on to require states to use eligible or registered voters. And the Supreme Court in this unanimous 8-0 decision said, no, total population is the metric. States can't be required to use eligible or registered voters. It's possible another challenge could come through the pipeline, but for now, this issue seems settled.
But my understanding is that, like you say, that states had the ability to count either way, but they almost all chose to do general population as opposed to population of voters. And that Blum and his crew wanted to force the state, like you said, to count only voters. And the Supreme Court, at least in the majority opinion written by Ginsburg, went beyond that, beyond saying that Texas has the right to choose, and actually sort of implied that, you know, we've never addressed the question of whether or not it's one voter, one vote per registered voter or not, but we are disposed to be against it. That, in other words, this guy not just lost his specific case, but they went almost a little further. I mean, I don't think a couple of the Thomas and Alito joined Ginsburg in this, but at least the majority opinion went even a little bit further, basically saying, like, if somebody brings us the specific challenge to the idea that you could have one vote per registered voter, we'd be inclined to go with general population.
That's what Ginsburg suggested. I mean, they left it based on my reading a little bit vague, but it didn't seem to leave much open to a further challenge. And the fact that this case was heard in the first place to me was quite disturbing, regardless of the outcome, because one person, one vote had worked fine for many, many years. There was no need to challenge it. There was no grassroots uprising to challenge something like this. The argument they were making was so far out there. It wasn't accepted by any courts previously. It was so extreme that the fact that this even came before the Supreme Court and the fact that this case was even argued in the first place in many ways was a victory for the plaintiffs, even though they ultimately lost.
All right. I know you're not as cynical and mean-spirited as I am, because you're a kinder person, a much more kind-hearted person. But tell me, are you encouraged by the death of Antonin Scalia? In other words, will this portend a re-establishment of voting rights down the road? Presuming we get a Democratic president, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, both of them can be counted on to nominate, in my opinion, judges who are going to be pro-voting rights. How long do you think it will take to restore the Voting Rights Act?
So I would never cheer the death of anybody.
Well, I know. I said that. Say, I prefaced
I will,
it. By...
I will say that it led to a lot of previously unexpected and unforeseen possibilities. And on not just voting rights, but on so many issues, the court ruled 5-4. And so if you replace Scalia with someone who was honestly just a centrist, you would move the court significantly to the left. And then if you replace Scalia with someone who was more of a liberal, then you'd move the court dramatically to the left. If you replaced the most conservative member of the court with someone who was on the center or the center left, that would be a dramatic shift. And the Voting Rights Act is a little complicated, because right now, like, Section 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act are dead. And so it's sort of hard to figure out how you'd necessarily resurrect it in the same way that you would overturn Citizens United, for example. But there probably would be some way to do it. And not only that, but there's a bunch of other issues on voting rights that the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on, like the future constitutionality of voter ID laws and a bunch of other things. And if you have a 5-4 centrist and progressive majority, it's very, very different than a 5-4 conservative majority.
And clarify this for me. Has a voter ID law ever gone to the Supreme Court? In other words, there is no, has it actually been, would a Supreme Court even have to deal with the idea of a stare decisis if a photo ID case came up to the court at this point? So
Indiana's photo ID law was upheld. The first of its kind was upheld in 2008. But there's many, many new ID laws are much tougher than Indiana's ID law. There's a lot more known about voter ID laws now. John Paul Stevens, who wrote that majority opinion in that case, has since become very critical of these laws, even though he's no longer on the court. So I think that the time to look at least the stricter version of these laws, that definitely a court is going to look at them more closely. I will just say that I think the Supreme Court has been lost a little bit on it as an issue in this election. We heard a lot about it after Scalia's death, that it's such an important issue. But now, like, everyone, all the, like, Hillary and Bernie supporters are calling each other evil without recognizing that their Supreme Court appointments would likely be pretty similar. And both of them would appoint pretty good people to the Supreme Court. So anytime I hear a Hillary supporter say they won't vote for Bernie or vice versa, and you're hearing more from Bernie supporters who say they won't vote for Hillary, does that mean they want another Justice Scalia or another Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court as opposed to a Justice Ginsburg, who, remember, was appointed by Bill Clinton?
Yeah, no, I think...
I just have to say this because this has been driving me crazy.
Well, it drives me crazy, and I, and the only reason why I haven't already said that today as opposed to every other day is that, I've wanted to let you talk, but this is going to be more of a topic. And I will say that I know that you are just too kind-hearted of a guy to have done the extreme dance that I did the moment I heard that Anna Scalia had died. I did one of those hotline bling dances, and it was really, I had no idea I was doing it until Myla came into the room, my daughter, and said, like, where'd you learn to do that? And I said, I don't know. It just sort of organically cropped up when I heard. So I just want you to know that though you are too sweet of a person to have that type of reaction, know that someone did in your name.
Okay, on the on the off chance that Newsbusters is recording this interview, I'm just going to not answer that question.
I understand, fully understand. Ari Berman, the book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Still doing book tours, ladies and gentlemen. Still on book tour. Do you have any more dates? This is just a function of how impressive a piece of, you know, it's an accessible book, but it really is a piece of scholarship. I mean, this is one of those books that I think is a reference for a lot of very smart people who are, you know, who write about this stuff, incidentally. So I just, again, a major achievement. But do you have any more book tours where people can go? And
I have a bunch of events. One that I'll mention that's probably of interest to some of your listeners is that I'm going to be speaking at the kickoff to this democracy awakening that's going on this weekend. You may have talked about this on your show in the past, but there's a big gathering of people that are concerned about voting rights, money in politics, other related issues. They're gathering in D.C. beginning on Saturday, and then there's going to be a march on Sunday, and there's going to be, I think, arrests and civil disobedience on Monday, and this is in addition to the democracy spring that's
right.
been happening this week where people have been getting arrested. So the next thing I'm doing is on Saturday in D.C. for that.
All right. Well, people can get more information where? Where can they go? Is there a place they can go to get more information or what?
The website Democracy Awakening.
There you go. Democracy Awakening.
I don't know. Google it. That's always my answer.
Look at the level of integrity. This guy, there's absolutely no self-promotion at all. Where would Newsbusters even go at this point? Where would they go?
It's probably on my website. Let me look. I haven't updated it in a few days. It'll be on my website momentarily, which is ari-berman.com.
ari-berman.com? We got to talk.
Well, I guess Ari
too.
Berman is so popular that someone took the first
probably Newsbusters. If you put in ariberman.com, it forwards to Newsbusters. Ari, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, buddy.
Great to talk to you, Sam. Thank Bye-bye. You.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Ari Berman. I got through the entire thing without even bringing up the fact that he still owes me money.
I mean, you did bring up betting.
But I did betting. That's true. I did. He didn't take. He took the bet, didn't he? We didn't come up with a number, but he said, "I think you're wrong." I'm just going to say $50.
You did a good job with the hotline
and
bling joke.
Do me a favor. Yeah, I had no idea. What
well
I was
delivered.
Saying. I had no idea. Michael,
it's a funny image if people know the reference. I'm sure.
We're going to cut in the $50 thing in post so that you're just going to have to manipulate that. So sometime after I say, let's bet, and he says, I think Maricopa is going to be on, and I say, how about $50? And just put in him saying yes in some way, and then we'll have it down.
And then also the hotline bling video.
Yes, you drop that in. In post-production.
I could put...
This is a live reenactment of Sam after he hears Scalia
every
dies.
Time, every time we talk...
He's doing the drink!
Every time we talk about Scalia dying, I'll put that music up just lightly underneath.
I will say...
Another bed.
I will say that I think there was probably a lot of smart self-restraint in my part for not shooting like myself dancing, like posting like some type of GIF.
Do you remember the exchange we had over text?
I honestly, my phone, this is the one time I think this has ever happened. My phone blew up. I mean, I got like 30 texts, and it was just like, and somehow I may have been on Twitter at the time, and it was just like, Scalia, !! Dead, !! Like, separate
but
text.
Remember what I wrote to you? I said, should I feel awkward at how sort of I don't think I said happy, but like how relieved I feel or something. And remember what you wrote back to me?
Something like he lived a long life and had the opportunity to do create a tremendous amount of destruction.
Yeah, you said something like, you're like, yeah, you should feel terrible. He lived a long, productive life of creating human suffering and destroying yes. lives. And I was like, oh, all right, great.
I think I actually had that copied on my, and I just... is this the song? Is this Drake? Is that what I was doing?
I think this is Hotline Bling. This is our new Scalia's Dead song.
Well, I think. I think I was a little bit more like.
Yeah, see. Well, without the grunt in your face, because you're more.
That's
happy.
The way I dance.
You always get.
That
little,
means I'm really
grit going on.
Digging it up. That's right.
New Dope Boys released right there. The dance is on.
What's you wanted to, today?
That's your Dope Boys release dance.
That was Michael trying to work in the Dope Boys.
But you
could have just brought
the,
it up.
You don't remember the tweet that someone did of you? They made a gif of you dancing.
Oh,
like
dancing?
That. Yes, that was how it related.
Two Dope Boys, new one dropped today, folks. If you have not subscribed to Two Dope Boys, you are missing out, and you're missing out one on a great new podcast that everybody's listening to. And two, you're missing out on an opportunity to help this program by basically just going over there and subscribing. So you can go to subscribe to DB, or you can just go to majority.fm and click on the big image of Two Dope Boys that's on the splash page. In the fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen, today, Cenk Uygur, arrested, and Adam Green from the PCCC, arrested in Washington, D.C. It's not a scandal, although I probably shouldn't have said that to get you to, it's like a tease to get you to go into the fun half. But we will talk about that. In addition, we will talk a little more about this Wisconsin story and Rick Scott being a huge a-hole. And the story of Democrats weaponizing Social Security expansion. I love it. I love it. We have come so far in 3 years where this could be a viable point of challenge. Adam Green had a big part in that, but also a lot of other folks in the... really sort of the blogosphere, if you will. Alex Lawson over at Social Security Works, Atrios, a lot of folks really pushed on this in a big, big way. Also, wanted to tell you that if you want to also help us, we are no longer eligible. I guess we've won a fifth award now from Podcast Awards, which is some type of legacy award. We're no longer eligible to win the People's Choice Award for news and politics. We broke it. We literally broke it by winning so much.
However, sick of it.
However, you can go over there and nominate Ring of Fire, which is a show that I co-host with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy on Best News and Politics, and show them that we will not be denied. That would help, you know, maybe we'll play... You know, so we do like a smaller interviews on that show. Sometimes we replay them here. We haven't in a while. I did a good one with Josh Fox the other day that maybe we will replay at one point over the vacation, although we're pretty chock-a-block full. Nevertheless, go check out that podcast. You can listen to the hour-long free version, or you can sign up to be a member of that podcast and get 3 hours plus bonus audio content. You can go to rofpodcast.com or, again, majority.fm. Click on the Ring of Fire link that you see at the front page. You'll see a big image of it. But either way, go to podcastawards.com and nominate the show for Best News in Politics. All right, going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half of the program, 646-257-3920. I'm turning on the IM right now. I hope Lawyer Matthew is the first one because I asked about his voter stuff, which he was giving me so much grief about. All right, we'll be right back after this. Setting up the page.